Welcome to the Deep Dive, your daily briefing on the most talked about stories from the Hacker News front page. Today is Thursday, May 1st, 2025, and we picked out five discussions that, well, really caught our eye.
Yeah, some interesting ones today.
We're diving into Redis, going back to open source. A judge's pretty serious accusations against an Apple exec. Some smarter ways to copy squatty databases.
Always useful.
The end of paywalls for NIH-funded research coming up soon. And the new Claude integrations.
Lots to cover.
Yeah, exactly. Our goal always is to give you the key insights fast, you know, so you can get up to speed and maybe think about things a bit differently.
Let's do it.
Okay, first up, Redis is open source again.
Right. So Redis Labs, or Redis Inc., now they've relicensed Redis and Redis Stack. They're putting it under AGPL v3.
Which is a big shift because they were using the SSPL before, weren't they?
Exactly. The server-side public license. And you might remember that caused quite a bit of concern in the open source community.
Yeah. I remember the idea was to stop the big cloud providers like AWS from just offering Redis as a service without, you know, contributing back.
That was the stated goal, but it led directly to Valky.
Ah, yes. The fork. AWS, Google. They backed that one, right?
Mm-hmm. And lots of Linux distributions and other open source projects started switching over to Valky pretty quickly.
So what's the reasoning now for Redis Inc.? Going back to AGPL, did the CEO say?
Yeah, there was a blog post. Basically, the CEO said that, well, since AWS and Google did create and maintain their own fork, Redis Inc.'s goal was effectively achieved.
Huh. That's one way to frame it, I guess. So they succeeded by forcing a fork.
It seems that's the narrative. But, you know, the big question now is, will this actually rebuild trust?
Yeah, because there's that feeling, isn't there, that once you move away from a permissive license like MIT or BSD towards something like SSPL, it's kind of hard to go back, like a one-way door.
It often feels that way. And then there's the whole debate about AGPL v3 itself. Is it really business-friendly?
Well, the argument is it forces cloud providers who modify the code for their service to release those modifications, right? Keeps things open.
That's the idea, yeah. Sort of a reciprocal obligation. But some businesses worry about it infecting their own proprietary IP if they link against it or integrate it in certain ways.
Right. And what about the companies, the users who already switched? Like, they put time and effort into migrating to Valky.
Exactly. If you've already invested heavily in migrating to Valky, maybe even contributed to it, what's the incentive to switch back now just because the license changed again?
Especially if Valky is, you know, developing independently, are there technical differences emerging?
Yeah, there are reports of Valky making improvements like better performance, memory efficiency. I think someone mentioned a modernized hash table implementation.
Okay, so it's not just a license thing anymore. There are potentially real technical divergences.
Precisely. And to add another layer, Redis Inc. is folding some of the Redis stack tech like JSON support, time series, and this new Redis query engine into the core Redis 8 release, which will be under AGPL.
That query engine sounds interesting. Could it be like an in-memory Elasticsearch alternative for certain things?
That seems to be the potential, yeah. So you've got Redis 8 evolving with these features under AGPL and Valky developing on its own path. It's getting complicated.
Definitely. And someone on HN even brought up Microsoft's Garnet.
Ah, yeah, the C# key value store.
Right. And, you know, inevitably that brings up mentions of Microsoft's old embrace, extend, extinguish history with open source. Creates a bit of unease for some.
Understandably. Trust is hard-earned in open source.
Okay, let's shift gears. Our second deep dive. Mm-hmm. This one's causing a lot of buzz. A judge has actually ruled that an Apple executive lied under oath.
Yeah, this is in the Epic Games antitrust case. And it's not just a ruling. The judge made a criminal contempt referral. That's serious.
Wow. Who was the executive and what did they allegedly lie about?
It's Apple's VP of finance, Mr. Roman. The court document points to specific things, like denying he looked at comparable rates for alternative payment systems.
Okay.
And also claiming Apple had, like, no idea what fee they'd charge for linked purchases until January 16th, 2024. The judge basically said these statements were false. Perjury.
Oof. And this connects to the whole ongoing saga about whether Apple is really complying with the original antitrust ruling, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There were comments on HN linking this, speculating if this exec could actually face jail time, which is, you know, pretty rare territory for senior tech executives.
It really is. You see a lot of hope in the comments that he'll be treated just like anyone else would be in that situation. pushing back against the idea that execs are somehow above personal consequences.
Right. The argument pops up that if you're earning those huge salaries, that should come with personal responsibility, even liability, if you break the law.
Someone mentioned Philip Schiller, didn't they? That he actually argued internally for complying with the injunction.
Yeah, there was a comment suggesting Schiller pushed for compliance, but that Tim Cook apparently overruled him or ignored the advice. Suggests maybe some disagreement at the very top.
Which ties into some broader criticisms you sometimes see about Apple's current leadership. People mentioning things like the perceived issues with Apple Intelligence or maybe declining software quality.
And suggesting maybe a bigger change is needed. It all gets woven together in these discussions.
Then there was the mention of Tim Cook's donation to Trump's inauguration a while back.
Yeah, some saw that as purely strategic, you know, trying to influence tariffs or something. But others felt it alienated part of their user base. Shows how complex these corporate decisions can be.
Definitely. What about the financial side? Did this news hit the stock?
Well, there was talk about the stock value dropping, but it's important to remember market cap isn't cash leaving Apple's bank account. And actually, Bloomberg seemed to link a recent dip more to weaker sales in China.
So probably a mix of things affecting the price. But there's skepticism, too, right? About whether anything will actually happen to this executive.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Lots of comments questioning if charges will even be filed or if they are, whether it'll lead to a conviction or maybe even a pardon later on. It raises that whole corporate veil question.
The difference between corporate liability and individual responsibility.
Exactly. And how corporations can sometimes shield individuals. People also brought up the user experience of those external payment links.
The scary pop-up.
Yeah, the feeling was that it was designed specifically to put developers and users off using those links, which kind of reinforces the antitrust concerns.
It's such a contrast, someone pointed out, to Apple being near bankruptcy back in 97. Now it feels like they're paranoid about losing even a tiny fraction of revenue.
It's a fascinating contrast. And of course, it all feeds back into the endless debate about the App Store cut 30% or 15% for smaller devs. Is it justified?
Compared to consoles, what Apple provides, the arguments go back and forth. Control versus openness.
It's a fundamental tension in the platform economy. This case just brings it all to the surface again.
Okay, topic three. Moving to something a bit more technical and practical. Faster ways to copy SQLite databases between computers. This generated some good tips on HN.
Yeah, always a useful problem to solve. Someone initially suggested running Pragma integrity check first, which is just, you know, good practice. Make sure the database isn't corrupt before you copy it.
Makes sense. But just sending the SQL insert statements or whatever isn't ideal, is it?
No, because then the receiving end has to execute all of that, rebuild indexes, maybe run vbaseum. It's inefficient. The built-in backup command got mentioned a lot.
Right, the official SQLite way to make a consistent snapshot for copying. Simple and reliable.
Definitely. And then there was Lightstream. That got quite a bit of love in the comments.
Ah, yeah, the tool for sort of continuous backup and restore, often used with containers. Someone mentioned an ex-Googler uses it everywhere.
That's the one. That kind of endorsement carries weight. The creator apparently uses it constantly, too. Seems really solid for backup scenarios.
What about speeding up the actual transfer? Incremental copies.
Our sync came up, naturally, using flags like in place and no whole file to try and send only the changed blocks.
But SQLite files change internally in complex ways, don't they? Does basic row sync handle that well?
It can be tricky. Which is why SQLite through sync was mentioned. It's specifically designed to be transaction aware and work with SQLite's wall mode, the write ahead log.
Okay, so it understands SQLite's structure better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's integrated into rsync.net.
Apparently so, though it does require you to be using wall mode and have the database on local disk, not network storage.
Gotcha. What about just making the file smaller? Compression.
Yeah, compression was discussed. Using gzip or faster options like ZSTD, LZUP, LZ4. Good if your network is the bottleneck.
But maybe not if you have a really fast local network.
Exactly. On a fast LAN, the CPU time spent compressing and decompressing might actually make the whole process slower. Someone even shared benchmarks they did on a RAM disk.
So it depends on your specific setup. What about DuckDB?
DuckDB was mentioned as a way to export table data efficiently into Parquet format using Z-standard compression. But that's just the data, right? Not the schema, indexes, the whole database structure.
Right. More for data portability than a full DB clone. I saw a comment about an old mainframe trick, too.
Oh, yeah. The skip the index and turn it on later idea. Dump the data without indexes, transfer it, load it, then build the indexes on the destination. can save a lot of time for large tables.
Clever. And piping the dump directly over SSH.
Yep. SQUITE3Source.db dump user at destination SQUITE3Destination.db or something similar avoids creating a big intermediate dump file.
Makes sense. It feels like a lot of these techniques are common for moving other databases too.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Just applied specifically to the nuances of SQLite.
Yeah.
Good practical discussion.
Okay, fourth topic. This is a big one for science and research access. Starting July 1st, 2025, academic publishers can't paywall research funded by the NIH.
Yeah, this is pretty significant. The National Institutes of Health, it's actually a Biden-era policy, but the NIH director accelerated the effective date of the public access policy.
And the reaction seems overwhelmingly positive, right? Like, this is just obviously the right thing to do.
Absolutely. The core sentiment on HN was, finally, and about time. The logic is simple. If U.S. taxpayers fund the research, the results should be freely available to those taxpayers and everyone else.
It seems hard to argue with that. Did it bring up related issues?
Oh, yeah. Someone immediately wished for freely available standards, too, like technical standards that are often behind paywalls. They mentioned HL7 FHIR as a good example of free standards funded by membership.
Good point. And the business model of the big journals came under fire again.
Definitely. You know, the prestigious ones like Cell, Nature, Science, where researchers often pay article processing charges, APCs, to get published, even for open access, and then institutions also pay hefty subscription fees. It feels parasitic to many.
So the suggestion was that funding bodies should just mandate open access publishing.
Yeah, basically require grantees to make any resulting digital materials freely available under open licenses like Creative Commons.
What about university libraries? Why can't they make their vast collections more digitally accessible? People mention things like LibGen or Sci-Hub.
Well, that gets into complex legal territory with copyright and publisher agreements. But this NIH move might create more pressure for change there, too. It's all connected.
How does this impact actually using the research, like with AI tools?
That came up too. People working on, say, LLMs for synthesizing medical evidence need full text access to papers. Getting that data, especially tables, ingested is a challenge. Tools like GrowBid, which parses PDFs into structured XML, become really important.
Were there any counterarguments or concerns?
A couple. One person pointed out, you know, tax dollars fund lots of things the public doesn't get direct access to, questioning where you draw the line. Another raised the concern that overall research funding might get cut, which could undermine the benefit of open access.
Valid points to consider. And there was some mention of recent controversy around the NIH itself.
Yeah, two things briefly. One was about the NIH website's search function, apparently censoring terms like gender, diversity, equity, inclusion, though users found workarounds.
Okay.
The other much more serious allegation mentioned in comments was about the NIH potentially suppressing the lab leak theory regarding COVID-19's origins. Again, just reflecting the discussion there, not taking a stance.
Right, just reporting what was discussed. Important distinction.
Right.
But the main thrust is excitement about the paywalls coming down for NIH research.
Overwhelmingly so.
Okay, final topic for today. Anthropic announced integrations for Claude. This was just today, May 1st. Looks like a move to make Claude more, well, integrated.
Exactly. They want Claude to work more smoothly with the tools you already use. It builds on something called the Model Context Protocol, MCP. Basically, it lets Claude talk to other apps and services, web or desktop.
And they launched with a bunch of partners.
Yeah. 10 to start. Pretty big names. Jira, Confluence, Zapier, Cloudflare, Intercom, Asana, Square, Sentry, PayPal, Linear, Plaid. And they mentioned more coming, like Stripe and GitLab.
That's a solid list. Covers project management, communication, automation, finance.
Right. Think about the possibilities. Zapier connects Claude to thousands of other apps. The Atlassian ones, Jira and Confluence, could be huge for developers and teams managing projects and documentation.
Or Intercom for customer support. Claude could maybe draft replies based on past interactions or help docs.
Precisely. Faster responses, maybe even help identify bugs quicker by correlating feedback. The idea is Claude can now search within these connected apps alongside its web search and Google Workspace search.
And they're providing citations back to the source within those apps?
Yeah, they emphasize transparency. Clear links back to the Jira ticket or Confluence page where the information came from. That's pretty crucial for trust.
Is this available to everyone?
The integrations and an advanced research feature are in beta for their paid plans, Max, Team, and Enterprise. But the basic web search is now global for all paid plans.
What do people on Hacker News make of it?
Mixed reactions, as always. Someone mentioned a bad experience with Kagi Assistant, saying its performance got worse when internet access was on, a potential pitfall for Claude, too.
Right, the challenge of integrating external context without messing up the core reasoning.
Exactly. Which led to a discussion about the kitchen sink approach, just dumping all possible context into the AI versus the risk of it getting, you know, confused or distracted.
Finding that balance, what's the ideal?
The dream, someone said, is an AI with perfect recall of everything, emails, docs, chats, without getting muddled. A huge challenge.
Definitely. Does this threaten other AI companies?
Well, it raises the bar. If companies have huge valuations based on promising revolutionary AI, actually delivering useful integrated tools like this becomes more important. It challenges the hype.
And what about enterprise tools like Confluence? People have been waiting for good AI features there.
Yeah, a comment noted that adoption of LLMs in tools like Confluence has felt slow. This kind of deep integration could be the killer feature for navigating massive internal knowledge bases, finally making sense of all that documentation.
That would be valuable. Any other interesting angles?
Just a mention of using command line tools like Elm to run language models locally on your own files. A different approach to integration, more user-controlled.
It really feels like we're just scratching the surface of how these AIs will weave into our workflows.
Absolutely. It's moving incredibly fast.
So to wrap up today's deep dive from Hacker News, Redis is back to AGP LV3 open source after the Valky fork emerged, creating uncertainty about trust and the future paths of both projects. An Apple VP faces a criminal contempt referral for allegedly lying under oath in the Epic case, fueling debate on executive accountability. We looked at practical ways to copy Glyte databases, from backup to rsync variants in Lightstream. A major win for open access is coming, as NIH-funded research will soon be free from publisher paywalls. And Anthropic's Claude is getting integrations with popular apps, pushing AI assistants towards deeper workflow embedding.
Which leaves us with a thought for you. As AI gets woven more tightly into everything we do, what do you think are the biggest ethical hurdles and practical roadblocks we really need to get ahead of?
Something important to consider. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the Hacker News front page. We hope it helped you get quickly informed on what's happening.
Until next time.